When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk Splits, where we bring back not one, but two former guests of the show that may or may not know each other for a always amazing conversation. And today is absolutely no exception. From the band Pansy Division, the legends John Ginoli and Chris Freeman are back on this show. And as I said, this is a good one. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, hit up the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother, Tristan Abraham, and the guest booker and show producer of this show, podcast. And he will get the message to me. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeffordDamian. There is a YouTube page that has video versions of this podcast. It takes me forever to edit them. You can find that on YouTube. There's a TikTok page for this podcast with like little edits on there. An Instagram page for this podcast. And all those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. Oh, and a Facebook page. And those are all run by Tristan as well. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. We have a brand new record called Another Day. It is available everywhere now. Thank you, everyone that has checked it out. I'm happy. Like, people are, you know what? It always blows my mind when you put out a record and people listen to it. So thank you, everyone, for the kind words and checking it out. And if you want to pick up the Turned Out of Punk edition, hit up Emissions Records in Toronto. They have the exclusive Turned Out of Punk edition, or they're distributing the exclusive Turned Out of Punk edition. And you can get it there. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, back on the show are Chris Freeman and John Ginoli from the band Pansy Division. They also have this incredible pre-Pansy Division history that we talk about a lot in their first appearances on the show, and we dive into again on this one. So go back and listen to their first two episodes. Fantastic conversations. Huge, huge fans of Pansy Division, Tristan and I, and meeting them as young people and just how cool they were, and just, you know, we were punishers and they were awesome to us, and, you know, really informed how I think bands should interact with people that like their band. And that is something I've tried to carry with me. And this is a fun one. There's a lot of stuff in this episode, and it goes for a while, because, you know, I got these guys on the phone. I'm not gonna let them go that easy. And I'm not gonna ramble on anymore. Check out the brand new 30th anniversary edition of their classic album Undressed, which has just been put out again by Sounds Red Records. You can find it. It looks like it's on like some sort of purple maroon vinyl. It looks really cool. And grab that record. If you've not heard this record, it is a masterpiece and should be in your collection, as all the Pansy Division records should be. They've got a lot of fantastic records and continue to make fantastic records. And they are going on tour, so you can hear them play all of this fantastic stuff. It starts in the middle of September, I guess September the 19th, in Boston, then Montreal, Toronto, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and then Ferndale, which is kind of, I guess, Detroit area as well. Throughout the month of September, find out more information and pick up your copy of Undressed and check out more Pansy Division stuff, music, everything, over at pansydivision.com. Now, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Please enjoy Chris and John from Pansy Division on Turned Out of Punk Splits. John and Chris, Chris and John, both of you, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It is a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I think in both cases, it's been years since you have been on.
I think three. That's years. Well, I was trying to find your, if I had an email from you, and I think the last time we did this was July of 2011.
Yes.
Or 2021. It was during... I think it was 21. Maybe it was 22. It was during pandemic.
Yeah, it was. And Chris, I think it's been even longer between your appearance on the show. I think it's been like 5 years, 6 years.
Oh my God. That's quite possible. Yes. Quite possible.
Both of you insisted that I couldn't possibly have more questions. And I assured both of you I did. And sadly, as I said off air, between then and now, I've also acquired much more knowledge about your previous lives and your previous bands. And so I'm very excited to talk to both of you again. I kind of wanted to start off though. You kind of started, we were talking a little bit about Albini, who recently passed away, rest in peace. And he of course comes up in Kathleen's Hannah's book. She tells a story about working with them and recording with them. But another thing that comes up in her book is how influential the Battle of the Garages Volume 2 is on her.
Whoa.
Yes, that was one of the first records she ever acquired.
Hmm.
And blew her mind when I told her that that was also an early appearance of yourself on record.
Wow.
I connections.
You never know. You know, records come out and they might sell, I don't know, a record like that, maybe 3,000 copies, maybe 5,000 copies. That's not nothing. And, who hears what can be so random. So, I mean, I love it. I love hearing that. But it's still really surprising to me.
Well, it's interesting because actually after you were on the show last time, we talked about where I first met you guys. And I said it was at CFMY when you appeared on CFMY. And Tristan, my brother, told me, no, we actually met before that. It was in the back of Rotate This when you guys did an instrument. And I think about it, maybe there's 25 people in there, and of those 25 people, at least half of them were in bands afterwards, and then of those, a bunch of them I know went on to do kind of interesting things in terms of creative careers. I'm sure all of them had interesting lives. I don't mean to diminish anyone else's life, but that was such a cool experience, and it was so transformative on my brother and I meeting you guys. I thought it was at CFMY that first encounter kind of happened, but it was there, and just how chill everyone in the band was. And this is, hot off you guys being this opening band for Green Day, and just be that kind of like ambassador gateway to this culture. Like you're saying, you don't know how many people hear this stuff, how many people see this stuff, but it does have an effect on the people that do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
You just never know what people are hearing when. And I think that's part of the reason why it's been very interesting 30 some years later now. Things still come up where people are like, if it weren't for so-and-so, I would never have heard you. And I can't believe it. And my life is whatever it is, those things still occur. And it just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because we never, I don't think, I mean, I'm not speaking for John, I'm speaking for myself. I never would have thought that we'd be here talking about this, right now. Like 30 some years ago, I'm like, oh my God, there's no way we could be forecasting that this was going to happen.
In our 60s, with a band that we started at the beginning of our 30s. So we're pretty old to begin this band. So but yeah. We were experienced. And I think that is one reason the band has had longevity, because we had both been in bands before that had some promise and some attention, but ultimately didn't really get very well known. But I feel like knowing, like all these things that I could talk about that would make no sense to anybody coming up in music now, like college radio is important, rock critics in zines and in magazines were important. It's such a different world now that it almost sounds like fiction that it once worked this other way.
Yeah, if you think about how much power so few people had back then to make or break artists, like people talk about like the Pitchfork era and the sort of power of the blogs, but the power of maximum rock and roll in punk is like that was true power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now, like you're saying, it's quaint because a band can kind of go out and within reason, but like carve their own space and make their own space and take their own space. I think a lot easier than it was for bands when there were cultural gatekeepers and labels and things like that preventing it.
I mean, labels still help, but I was, as you were saying that, I thought, well, you know, a band can come out of nowhere and get their foot in the door and suddenly they explode. And one of the bands recently like that is Wet Leg, who I really like. And, you know, they had one video. I remember when it had 1,000 views on YouTube. And, you know, now it has like tens of millions. But, you know, they were not hyped. It was really a pure thing. There are a lot of bands who put out a little video and suddenly people are really... So things can go viral as opposed to the slow, steady, hopefully upward trajectory of making records and going out and touring them in a van.
Yeah. And I think the power of a song now is I guess more powerful, for lack of a better word to put it, because like, if you have a good song, which is what Wet Leg had, they had a bunch of like really killer songs and that can find an audience versus like Outnumbered is a band I've dove into a lot more. I think that box set coming out, but I think after our interview, I kind of like listen to you guys and, you know, granted there was a band in Germany covering you in 88, but like there's so many killer songs on that record. And I think we talked about it last time. It's just like not finding necessarily traction outside of that one spin review later on. It's kind of hard to for those songs to kind of, you know, reach their full potential.
Well, maybe you should explain a few things to people who are listening to this. Like the box set you're talking about is not an Outnumbered box set. It's called Strum and Thrum. And it was like in England, they always had this thing about C86, the NME cassette that spawned 1,000 jangly, garagey punk bands, sort of twee bands, like, you know, Tallulah Gosh and Heavenly and the Shop Assistants and people like that. And it's this whole British subculture. And then in the 80s, there was this American underground subculture, a lot of which is really influenced by REM. And there was a whole underground around that that got compiled onto this Strum and Thrum compilation that came out, I think, 2 years ago on Captured Tracks, who I love because they reissue all the Martin Newell and Cleaners from Venus stuff to get super fucking obscure. But yeah, the Outnumbered was the band I had before Pansy Division. And, you know, I don't run across many people like you who know that or, you know, have, you know, interacted and loved those records. But we made three of them. And that's what I did before Pansy Division. And then Chris has his own story about, you know, making records before Pansy Division too. So...
I find you guys like your parallel journeys in 80s American underground pre this explosion, which obviously you participate in, that changes the musical landscape in a lot of ways. But I find that one of the most interesting parts of Pansy Division that I learned kind of after being a fan of your music as a young person, but later on. And like
you brought up REM, and I think like the story of the American Underground at that point is almost like one of two sounds or two like bands that I guess are like lightning rods for these types of sounds, where you've got the Butthole Surfers representing sort of a more aggressive sort of anti-commercial pop sound. And then you, on the other side, you're like, you're saying REM is kind of like doing the other thing and sort of like never shall the two meet, except for the fact that I guess Butthole Surfers used to stalk Michael Stipe pretty aggressively.
Well,
yeah.
I read some article with one of the Butthole Surfers guys recently talking about how ashamed they were of how obnoxious they were. But you know, it took 30 plus years to get to that point.
I think that's
a long time too.
Yeah. Well, I think it can take an insurmountable time to grow up for some people. I think I heard you stop maturing the moment you become a professional musician, because that's when you stop having to relate to the real world.
No, a lot of people get more immature once they become professional musicians.
Oh, I think we know a few, John.
Go to their head. So.
We know a few intimately.
But I guess like the kind of like the place that's leaning to more towards this sound, that's like the more kind of like anti-commercial, still ultimately pop music, but like that whole Butthole Surfers thing is what we talked about last time, Chris, with Seattle. And you brought up H-Bombs, who I kind of didn't know anything about H-Bombs is a French thrash band, H-Hour. And dove into them a little bit more. So I guess you have that sound in Boise, Idaho, too. And it's sort of like Pacific Northwest
Tag thing. Tag came from there. Even Jeff Ament from Pearl Jam, Green River and Pearl Jam came from there. Or no, he came from Missoula, Montana. He was more Montana, right.
And Boise, wasn't that where Septic Death was from?
Oh, yeah. I had a roommate, Pauly Birnbaum, was the drummer for Septic Death. And he was my roommate for like 3 or 4 years in San Francisco. Yeah,
that's awesome.
But you know, how much influence did Septic Death have in Boise? Not much. But you know, you could point to something that happened there.
Yes, and I would say you're right. They didn't have a huge influence, but they did have an influence. And then you look at State of Confusion, who kind of is, I guess, the next band, ultimately on Subcore Records too, out of Seattle. And then they evolve into the Tree People. And then that eventually becomes Built to Spill. So you do have this sort of like,
right,
you know, sonic, I guess, legacy, not really represented in Built to Spill sound, but they're very vocally championed by members of Built to Spill, I promise, on past episodes of the show. So, yeah, I guess what you talked about before, the ripples of this thing. You never know who you're going to influence and where that's going to go.
It's been brought up to me. What was interesting just recently is I went to a family section of my family reunion. So it's all the nephews and nieces below me. And I'm the only one of the upper family that, because I always used to have to be seated at the card table, you know, on Thanksgiving with all the nieces and nephews while the adults had their meal. So they treated me like one of theirs, you know, gobble, gobble, hey, one of ours. But one of them they have kids. And so here's my great nieces and nephews, and they were doing a project about famous people from certain cities. And they said, well, my uncle used to live in Aberdeen. Let's see. Oh, he's on the famous people register along with Kurt Cobain, of course, and Kurt Vanderhoof from Metal Church. We were all, well, not, I wasn't in the same grade with them, but Kurt Vanderhoof and I were in the same grade. And then also David Rudacrona, who was the first bass player in The Lude, one of the bass players in The Lude, he also was in that same grade level with me in high school. So I was like, how did all these people from Aberdeen, and you know, then you got Buzz and people from Montesano 30 miles away. It's crazy.
Brought up Metal Church in the Lude there. That was like a band I forgot to ask you about last time that I was kicking myself about. Because they're a band that hugely influential. They came up in the Joey Keithley episode, one of the first punk bands to kind of play. They played with in DOA, pre-DOA in Vancouver. Yeah. Did you ever get to see them, or like obviously in the same grade?
I didn't see them because I left Aberdeen in 77, summer of 77. And I lived there for about 3 years. So, and because I was the new guy in Aberdeen and, you know, Kurt and David Ruderkrone grew up there. So they had already staked their place in the hierarchy, but you know, the new guy always gets picked on. So I was the one getting picked on. And I remember Kurt Vanderhoof sort of was also a little bit ostracized, but he would never come out to me. And I know why, because as soon as he would, his stock would plummet, you know? So he couldn't really say anything. So I remember trying to like, oh, I see you have a Black Sabbath something on your peachy, you know, and he'd be like, nah, move on. I can't be associated, you know, because I was actively being picked on. So I don't know where I was going with that story, except to say that, no, I never got to see them back in the day, but I did meet David Wayne. Again, in 1983, I think, we went to Steve Lawson Productions and they were just mixing Highway Star and Metal Church and with Terry Date. And it was his first record. And he was first, you know, like, okay, wow, this guy, the great sound on the drums. Oh my God. You know, because he was like, you know, that beginning of Metal Church. Oh my God. And to hear that, and that we were like, Terry, you're doing our next record for sure. So his first, and Terry Date later became, you know, he did Soundgarden, then he did, you know, all those huge metal bands for, in the 90s. So he went to make a huge name for himself.
It's interesting with Metal Church too, because they've come up, well, obviously the Lou thing on the podcast a couple of times, but Kathleen Hanna sang on that Metal Church record later on.
No shit.
Yeah, like I think it's their like last, or maybe not last, sorry, obviously, but like 95, 97 era.
Wow.
That,
and also I gotta, that's insane. I'm gonna look that up. Another little tidbit is on the inside of the Metal Church album, on the original, I don't know, the original pressing, it had a sheet on the inside. And you pull it out and it had merchandise and there was a neck brace with the Metal Church logo on it right here. And we used that photo as a center for, I think for the, for those about to suck cock, we had it. So the mouth, the pin in the middle would go right through his mouth. So we took that from the Metal Church, right directly from that sleeve.
That's amazing. Well, you know, this might just be my hyperfixation on connections. So excuse me if I'm going down an extra nerdy
path. Oh, I love it. Look at all but these little connections.
Also featured on that same song on the Metal Church record is Alison Wolfe from the band shit. Bratmobile.
Of course, yeah.
Who also featured Molly, who was at Lookout Records the end of Lookout Records. So there's like this weird, you know, given the fact that John, you're in this band that plays a role in influencing Kathleen Hanna's journey. Like the weird connection intersection through Metal Church is heavy for my cannabis addled mind.
I love it. I love it.
Were you familiar at all with like the Whiz Kids or the Tupperwares or any of that kind of stuff? That was like, I guess it's like proto-punk, but the Whiz Kids, the Whiz Kids, as I've been corrected on, were like, I guess, like somehow connected to the Cockettes and sort of like the San Francisco sort of early performance drag kind of scene.
I've heard people talk about it, but I was not familiar myself. I mean, I moved to San Francisco in 87. So a lot of that stuff was already over.
Yeah. And I remember the Tupperwares were like talked about in the same breath as like the Screamers. Or somebody like that. But I never heard
that. Shared members with the Screamers.
Ah, okay.
Tamat was in the Tupperwares, and I'm trying to think, maybe someone else. And
that's what I thought was a connection there, yeah.
They're a fascinating band. Like El Duce was in it for a minute.
Oh, wow.
Nikki Sixx apparently played with them too for a hot second.
Frank Ferrano, yeah.
Well, there's like this Bill Rifflin, I guess, played with them too, apparently, or something. There's like this.
Oh, that makes sense.
it seems like there's like this sort of like hyper heavy music scene, like not like at your high school too, but there's like you're saying, there's such these small little pockets of intense musical talent that were all grouped together.
Yeah. Well, here's a connection I don't know if you know about. Chris, would you like to explain your connection with Spinal Tap?
Please. Yes.
I think I didn't talk to you about that before.
No.
All right. Well, it was the last straw for me, honestly. I will just put it that way, because after that, I gave up music. I sold some of my gear.
Well, hold on.
I know. I'm gonna. Right, and then after this experience that I had, I'm like, I am so done. But I kept reading the music papers, and it took a couple of years before I saw John's ad. But the final straw for me was, I guess it was
straw about what?
Middle of 89 or 90, I gave up music for good. I knew I was coming up on 30. It was, you know, so I thought, all right, I'm not going to get signed. It's going to take 2 to 3 years to get any band off the ground, to get it noticed by a major. And I'm already going to be over 30. When I moved to San Francisco, the project that I moved down with, we just folded, and I said, okay, well, I've got one more shot. I'm going to go out and give it a shot. And I found this band, they put an ad in there, Model Citizens. And they, you know, I don't even remember what they were looking for, like what it said they were looking for. But I remember going to the audition, and I look in the door, and I'm like, oh shit, that's Viv Savage on keyboards. David Caffinetti over on keyboards. And I'm like, you're in Spinal Tap. And he said, well, yes. And what's your name? And I'm like, so I ended up getting the gig, but I lasted maybe about 4 or 5 months, not quite even 6 months, I don't think. And the music was terrible. It was so bad. It was like if you tried crossing Sisters of Mercy and Journey.
You brought this band, but you did not. You buried the lead on the Spinal Tap connection. Yeah, I just re-listened to the episode, and I assure you, the Spinal Tap thing was not there.
Not there. Okay.
That adds a whole new dimension to this. That's fantastic.
So he's playing with this guy in Spinal Tap, and he's just like, fuck this. I'm not getting anywhere. He didn't play again until he saw my ad. Although I have to say, when I met you, I feel like you were playing in other bands. You were looking for things again.
Oh, but I was playing with Steph and Sally. We were just having little shenanigans in the studio and stuff. But it was only after you and I started playing live that I was making any connections to the clubs to be able to pitch those ideas to. But no, actually, I was doing just helping other people out as a producer and as a bass player occasionally.
That's the other thing I find interesting is the parallels that both you know, obviously, John, you don't walk away from it as hardcore as Chris does, but like,
actually, I did.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what I mean. Like, you do take this break and you eventually come back to it and start playing. But it's interesting that both you guys kind of meet this perfect point. And like you're saying, you have this past experience with what doesn't work and what does work in terms of the ego management is the hardest part of band life, I think, more than anything else, and just like how to interact with other people and bandmates. And I think, yeah, it's you learn a lot over the years.
Yeah,
it's been more than 3 years since the Outnumbered broke up before I started Pansy Division. I did not intend to start another band until I realized that this idea I had for a gay band, that no one else was going to do it. So I had sold all my gear. I did not own a guitar. I did not own an amp. I owned nothing. I moved to California with one guitar, and I sold it when I lived in LA for a few months before I moved up. So I had no intention of forming a band. And he had no intention of being in a band anymore.
Nope.
I had the idea to start a gay band that would be uncensored and and just do it for fun. It's just like, we have no career. Let's just do whatever we want. Who knows if anybody will like it?
Right. Well, the thing that John
caught on pretty fast.
The thing that was interesting, though, is that I think John already had made it up in his mind. He'd already gotten over this hump just by creating the idea. But for me, it was like I had to go through the process of, oh, he wants to play these songs in front of people. Like he's serious. He wants to play these in a club in front of people on stage. That was the
sing this song, the cocksucker.
That's the one that made me laugh the most. And I just thought, oh my God, the cocksucker club. I'm going to be singing the cocksucker club. Let me get that through my mind. Okay. Let's do it.
So the thing is, I'm a hack guitar player and Chris is a great musician. And he was, you know, playing with other people who had great musical abilities. And yet I was the one who had the ideas that were more interesting.
And the songs.
That's right. Attitude gets you so far, but if you don't have songs, you fade out. So, you know, I had written a bunch of songs and, you know, I after writing some, I just got so excited and wrote a whole bunch more.
It was also interesting seeing you from a fan's perspective that it was almost like there were two front people when at the live show too, where Chris, like, obviously mm-hmm. you're the lead singer and you're doing, like, you know, explaining your songwriting thing, but also Chris is there. You know, like a Jagger and Richards kind of dynamic where you have two people to kind of like play off each other on stage and interact with the audience. And it makes for a more dynamic live show. Like, and that's what I've kind of like begin to notice in bands that kind of really work on a live level is where there's not just one person trying to hold it together and trying to be like the sort of the MC, where there's right. That sort of like thing that you had where, like, yeah, Chris, sometimes you would be telling stories, introducing songs. And then other times, John, you would obviously be introducing some of the songs that you were writing and stuff too. So it's like, I don't know. I thought it was a really cool thing to see as a fan.
Well, also we were only a three piece then. Mm-hmm. So Chris was on the left, one side of the stage, I was on the other. So we kind of looked like equals. I wasn't standing in the middle. And when we got a guitar player later, then I was in the middle. But you know, Chris always, the longer the band went on, the bigger the role Chris had.
Well, not only that, but I think it was our first tour where we went, oh, we don't have the dancers with us, because in San Francisco, we had like between 4 to 8 dancers in costumes, signs, like big signs, you know, hand painted, or, you know, and then like wrapped in cellophane or something, you know, just crazy, you know, whatever they wanted to bring to the table. And then all with cans of silly string and, you know, all going nuts. And if you see me, sometimes you'll see photos of me earlier when I've got a little Steinberger bass. And that's because these dancers would come in and they'd knock me out of tune in the middle of a song. And I'm like, that I gotta,
oh, I
do
forgot
something.
That's got why so you many, did that.
That's why I bought that $150. But they would knock me out of tune on stage because we play on these postage stamp stages with all these dancers.
And they've then got when we, signs that say use a condom or fuck off.
Yes. And so, you know, now we're like, oh, we're going out on tour and like, oh shit, we don't
have to be the entertainment.
They were so entertaining, and now it's just me and John up there. What are we going to do? And we just made it. And then Green Day a year after our first tour, 1 year later, now we're having to really become as big as possible because we're playing on way bigger stages.
It was really hard to be a big personality because I was used to playing on little stages. You have to run around a lot.
And the most telling part, and I've got a picture of it somewhere, I got to find it, is when we come out and John had this little Fender two speaker and we put it on a folding chair in front of Billy Joe Stack's
huge guitar. Marshall Stack. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, I just saw Green Day play the other day in Toronto. And
oh, right on.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, a huge stadium. Obviously, the stadium you guys played with them was a smaller stadium at that point as they're on the sort of like ascent. But it felt like, I don't know, just felt like the whole audience was there the whole time. Like, it felt like this culture that was kind of being brought out to the world, like en masse for the first time. And I mean that in like sort of like West Coast Bay punk culture, and the Riverdales being sort of, I guess, an extension of that sort of lookout sound too, a little bit. And that tour, I don't know, just felt like there, you guys would have been playing to a very different vibe of a room than you would be in San Francisco. And it's almost like two different bands existing.
I sure wish they would have gotten us instead of the Smashing Pumpkins.
It would have gone over better than Smashing Pumpkins. I promise you.
We haven't talked to Green Day in a decade, more than a decade.
Yeah.
And, you know, we should have just said, because we talked about, we said, when you do Dookie, when whatever year you do the anniversary, you need to bring us out and have us open for you once. Not do a whole tour. We can't do that now. But, you know, have us on one show. But, you know, did we speak up? No. Would they do it? Probably not.
I don't know. I don't think the episode with Billy that I recorded, not because of Billy at all, but is ever going to come out. But so I feel like I'm not spoiling anything by talking about it now. But like, we did talk about probably one of the most important cool things they did, and not overstating what they did as this brave decision, but like one of the coolest things they did from a fan's perspective, and he kind of feels as a band's perspective too, was bringing you guys out on that first tour.
Oh, make no mistake, that was brave.
It was brave.
They were super. They were,
I felt brave for being there.
Yes, they were, and because they come out and they'd be like, "Shame on you, assholes!" For, you know, and that were, you know, people like, if we had a really bad night, if we had a bad night, yeah, if we had a bad night, they would come out. They were watching the shows. I mean, they, you know, I remember Mike had a video camera and he filmed us at one show. And I remember it was with Danny and we played Vanilla. And it was one of the first times we were playing Vanilla in front of people. And I remember, because we were getting so much stuff thrown at us, and Mike had the camera on fisheye lens from the side of the stage. And there's this little break in the song, Vanilla, I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla, dun, 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 dun. And then it comes in. Well, there's a coin that hits Danny's cymbal right at that point. It goes, dun, 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 ting. And we fell apart laughing so hard in their bus watching that. Just like, oh my God, we back it up and play it over and over again.
You guys got to reach out just to get that video.
Their walls are so high. There are layers to get to them.
I know who to go to, but, or at least I knew who to go to.
Bill from Monsula and Pinnock Gunpowder, still there. TM does everything for him, and Jason from Chino Horde is still playing guitar and with him and stuff. So yeah, like, I feel like obviously they've gotten, it's so wild going to that show and realizing like, oh, this would be like seeing, I guess, Led Zeppelin in the 90s as a kid. Like, if Led Zeppelin had toured, I mean, in the 90s, like, that's the level of sold out stadium show this kind of is at this point. And it's weird how big it was for me as a kid, and only to see it become like this generation's classic rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Like you're saying, you guys were playing like some pretty, I imagine, like hostile crowds that, well, you guys, you talked about it last time, Chris, on the show, where like you're getting mail afterwards from kids that are like, oh, you guys are the first time I'd ever seen, quote unquote, seen a gay person from these people. And it's like, yeah, like that must have been, talk about brave. Like it's one thing to bring a band on tour. It's another thing to be that band on tour.
And then I think about the number of people, because for me, my first concert ever was Kiss in 1977, and Cheap Trick opened. So therefore, Cheap Trick was the first band I ever saw live. So a lot for that era, a lot of those kids, that we were the first band they saw live. That blows my mind too. Like that kind of impact that Cheap Trick had on me my entire life. I mean, I'm talking about them to this day, you know, and now, you know, so here we have other people doing the same with us. It's crazy.
That's my brother. My brother had been to see Rod Stewart at the Sky Dome with me and my mom as a kid, but you guys were his first band he saw live, because he went to that Green Day show and came back and was like, I saw this band. I was grounded, so I couldn't go. They blew my mind, and like, you got it. We got to see him. And then you guys came really hot on the heels of that, I think, on your own tour, right? Like it was pretty, you guys must have been on the road a lot that year.
Oh, for the next three or four.
We, you know, when we played with Green Day, there was a 10-month period between the first show and the last show, four different drummers. So that was a tough period for us in the way that we were just trying to keep it together at a time when everything we wanted to have happen was happening. So, you know, we have Luis now, but we didn't get him until the end of 96. And all this stuff was happening in 94, 95. So it was, you know, by the time we solidified things, we were kind of past the Green Day hump that really had elevated us from down here to, you know, this much popularity. And then it gradually goes down. But, you know, unfortunately, Luis missed the hysteria. And, you know, it's really too bad because he's great.
Yeah, you realize how much it has come down to timing and like what happens when and momentum. And
it was a cultural moment when we came along. The cultural moment was right for this idea that I'd had. And I hadn't done it because the cultural moment felt wrong. And then suddenly I thought, okay, not only is the time right, I'm the one that needs to do it, because I'm the one who needs to do it my way and show the world.
That moment that you're talking about is like, I wouldn't be here. My brother wouldn't be here without that moment. And as much as you guys weren't able to capitalize because of obviously lineup issues, it's like we talked about, I guess I've already brought it up, like the amount of people that did see you after that, like, that were coming out of those shows, it's amazing how many of those kids were, you know, like you were their gateway to this sort of thing. And like,
well, we didn't really, I mean, we couldn't have guessed what was going to happen to Green Day. You know, we could never have guessed, but we did realize that we did not have the drummer that we needed, but we went ahead and said yes anyway, because we knew that it was going to be the right thing to do. But I remember John and I both going, oh, who are we going to get? I mean, and then as it turned out, we got this guy who we'd met on tour who mailed us a cassette, but it wasn't him playing. As we found out later, we're like, that's not possibly you. No way that's you playing.
But we got through the tour, and I didn't want to get through the tour. This was the summer part of the tour. With the drummer we wanted, the only drummer we could really get. And then when the fall came around, we played with Danny Panic from Screeching Weasel, Riverdance. Yeah. So that was much better. That first drummer would not have flown on the big stages.
Oh God, it was so embarrassing. It was embarrassing.
We didn't get along with them either. So it was,
I mean, playing these songs in front of people was embarrassing enough in a certain way, but
yeah,
and really trying to sell them, but then trying to sell them when you got somebody who's sucking ass on the drums. Oh God.
Yeah, since both you guys were on, Danny Panic's been on, and one of the sweetest people I've ever met. Like, such a nice guy, and obviously an incredible drummer, too.
Yep.
And speaks very fondly of those tours with you guys and just how
we asked him to join our band.
Oh, we were on our knees.
We did get down on our knees and said, would you please join our band? And he said no. And
there's not even a recording. There's just video. There's just video of us. There's no actual recordings of new songs or anything that he played on, because he had a lot of good ideas. A lot of them we took.
But I think he was kind of intimidated by Ben Weasel, who did not like him playing in our band at all, because he hated our band.
Well, not only that, but he made a big stink. He said, how dare you play with a band that's signed to a major label? And then, oh, the next summer, the Riverdales are out with them. Oh.
It's also weird because Ben has that deep connection to Bruce LaBruce and sort of that whole, I guess, Blab or JD's kind of scene up here in Toronto.
Yeah.
You know what? I don't want to talk about Ben Weasel.
You don't have to edit anything out, but yeah, that's enough.
I didn't believe me. I don't
just leave that in.
If you're okay with that, I do want to talk about Bruce LaBruce. And because, like, when he was on the show, he talked a lot about, and this is obviously pre you guys, like this idea of making his own gay punk playlists and culture by like taking songs that might be homophobic in some cases and reinterpreting them and turning them into an anthem and sort of this idea of like reclaim culture, which Chris, you kind of talked on a little, you and I talked about a little bit with This Heat or the Heat last time with I Don't Like Your Face, that song.
Oh,
and
yeah,
having a homophobic
yeah.
line and like just being like, I gave him that pass
because
of it. But like it's, and I don't know, but maybe both of you guys can talk about, but this idea of this sort of like adversarial culture that existed in punk and sort of like the relationship with reclaiming certain aspects of it or rejecting other aspects of it prior to you guys, because obviously 1991's a change happens and Crudos and all this stuff that kind of Martine talking about sexuality and then
and I hesitate to say that we did all of it, but you know, you mentioned Bruce,
especially
and
now
Fifth Column were before us. Mm-hmm. But when I say that we're the first punk band, I wasn't sure Fifth Column really existed. They had a record, and I had to search high and low to find it. And but you know, they were first. They were before us, but they were absolutely invisible unless you were in Toronto. So I you know, was going ahead with my thing, having never heard them. Only they were like a rumor. And but you know, Bruce had the idea to call it homocore, and I think that was his idea. And I found that very, very convenient, you know. And I eventually got my hands on one of the JD's magazines that he put out, and a copy of the JD, what was it, top 10 tape that he put out.
The JD's jukebox.
Yeah, that's
the
one I have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Amazing compilation tape. And like you're saying there, and obviously like the Dicks and Gary Floyd and the Big Boys and certainly, but like, and not to undercut the work that other people did, like you're saying,
right.
But they didn't necessarily have on the covers of their records that sort of overt display of sexuality. And it wasn't necessarily.
Or even in the lyrics. So that's what, you know, I thought was missing. It's like, I know there's gay people making music. I'm pretty sure I've, you know, seen some of them that, you know, are bands that I like, but no one's talking about it. So I just thought it needs to be talked about. We don't have a career to lose, unlike so many people I could name. And so I thought, okay, we'll do it. And I think we made it easier for some people to come out because they weren't the weirdos over on the fringe. So,
John and I sat there like, who is there anybody we're missing? And you didn't have the internet back then. We couldn't just look things up like you can now. I mean, it's easy to rewrite history and go, well, look at all these things that were there before you. Well, yeah, but they weren't available to us. We couldn't find them. We, if we're going to make a bold distinction, like we're the first of something, we did exhaustive research to try and figure out, are we really the first?
I started the band because there wasn't one. So that was my whole thing. I remember I'd retired. I'd quit music. I had no idea that I was going to play music ever again.
So, and you worked for a record distributor, so you would have known. It would have been right under your nose.
I worked for Rough Trade.
Yeah, the only person I'd say that is kind of proto in what she's doing to what you guys are doing a little bit later on, but like by the time her records were coming out versus the demos, I don't think the sexuality was as overt as like Stick It In Me and those early demos, but Jane County and that Trouble, like that first Trouble of the Truck, I think, recordings that have come out that were like the demos that Bowie was paying her for.
But I didn't know if it was gay or if it was gender, because you also had Wendy William Carlos way back in the 70s. So I kind of put that as more of a gender issue, not a sexuality issue.
I had a date with a guy in San Francisco right when I was starting Pansy Division. And I told him what I was doing. And he said, well, what about these? And he pulls out the two Wayne County and the Electric Chairs albums. And we listened to them. I'm like, yeah, where's the gay content? And, you know, but Jane County is a pioneer. I don't want to disparage Jane County.
Not at all.
But I didn't, you know, what I wanted to see, it wasn't that. It was something that was more out. It was more in your face. It was more direct. And, you know, I give her credit.
Absolutely, right.
But at the same time, I felt like there was something missing. And, you know, Chris and I both had the experience in the 80s of being in bands where we were the only gay person. So he was writing songs for a woman to sing so he could write songs and blur the gender. And I had, in The Outnumbered, I had three very supportive straight guys. But I thought, if I'm going to sing songs about guys, even though I was like the main singer-songwriter in the band, I felt like that would be pulling rank. I thought that would be subjecting them to something they didn't get into it for. It's like, I want to represent my band. And I didn't feel like I could really be that out. And I also didn't think that there'd be any purpose at that point. But I thought, well, after The Outnumbered broke up, I thought, if I ever have another band, it's going to be a gay band. But that seems so far-fetched. You know, I sold all my gear. I didn't think I'm going to work up to this. I just didn't think it was possible.
I had no idea. Like later, I found out there were other gay musicians in Seattle that were friends of mine. And I'm like, oh, shit, you really? Okay, why didn't we talk about it then? But at the time, I thought I was the only one until I saw that article from John. And in fact, I think I even had to tell a friend because I thought it might have been a trap because there was a lot of gay bashing going on right about then. I thought it might have been a trap, somebody trying to set a trap to lure a gay person to their house. So I said, okay, I'm going to this person's house. He says he's got a band. He wants to play me some songs, but I don't know if it's true or not.
You could have said, meet me at... You know,
yeah, but I figured we were going to listen to music, and I thought, well, you know, you're not going to play music out in the park or something. I don't know, but that's how for me, I was like, another gay person in music. That's so far fetched.
Another gay person in rock.
In rock,
I have to specify.
Yeah, that's true.
In rock, a lot of people correct. Who are gay doing dance music.
That's true.
I wish I had interest in that. But I
do you.
I think judging from the last conversation, I don't think you really wish you had interest in that kind of music.
No.
But like you're saying, there's famously bands.
I mean, in a way I did, because it's alienating to be in a gay environment and not being able to enjoy that.
True.
Well,
sorry, Damien.
No, and that's kind of also what Bruce LaBruce talked about too, is the idea of like trying to make a gay culture that's not part of necessarily what's considered or taken up at least as mainstream gay culture at that time, and like wanting to be out and celebrate it, but not want to have to listen to those songs or those records.
When I wrote my book, I think I said this in the book that you know, Malcolm McLaren had this idea for the Sex Pistols before there were any Sex Pistols that he had rounded up to play. And I feel like with Bruce LaBruce and Homocore, he like created the genre before there were any bands that could, that were there to play it, but he willed it into existence. It's like he had this idea, even though he wasn't a musician, to try to, you know, describe this thing that, you know, he, you know, you read a zine, you think there's a homocore scene in Toronto. There wasn't, but you know, you can dream.
And you can make one, because like a couple years down the line, you know, there's Vaseline and there's Will Monroe and there's like this whole kind of like scene that is inspired by it. Or like, you know, Kevin Hagee, who's like another disciple of Bruce LaBruce, who just made that movie Tramps, and sort of like this, you know, it eventually, like, you're planting the seeds that, yeah, like you will it into reality. If I build it, they will come. And yeah. I think it's also like, not to go keep going back to Jane County, but like, Chris, you brought it up last time. You had a conversation with a guy from a major label on that Green Day tour. And you're like, do you think they'll ever be, you know, could we sign to a major label? And he's like, why would you? We'd have to put warning signs on your records. And John, when you bring up those Jane County and the Electric, or Wayne County, and those Electric Chair records, the sexuality versus those early demos, which you guys would not heard by, because they only came out in like 2017 or 14. Mm-hmm. It's so dialed back. And like what was permissible for, you know, her back then versus, you know, not because of, it was permissible because you guys forced the space open, but because there was this sort of alternative music channel to kind of like put out right. These records and distribution channels.
That's what had grown in the decade plus between when Jane County went to England, because you couldn't get a record deal in New York. You know, that the early punk era in England was an explosion of independent labels. In America, the punk bands are on majors in the 70s, and they didn't sell. But, you know, that's where a lot of them started out. So all those CBGB's bands that did get signed, you know, to Sire Records or, you know, whoever else was scooping up bands then. So you have this situation where the infrastructure wasn't there yet to support a band like us. So there wasn't a Lookout Records we could go to and say, oh, we'd like you to put out our album. And that had to develop, and it developed over the 80s because there's such this big gap between creativity and rock music and what was on the radio. The gap just kept getting bigger and bigger, so these smaller labels kept getting bigger and bigger till, you know, it culminates with Nirvana. And then Green Day.
This is what I wanted to bring you up with you in regards to Undress, because like 1991, the year punk broke, Nevermind explodes, everything kind of changes. But when Larry Livermore was on the show, he's like, it's not really as important to what was going on in San Francisco, the Bay, as it is in other places, because Faith No More and Mortem, we were already on our way to doing something here. And like Operation Ivy came out the same, well, before Nirvana, right? And Green Day's out around the same time. And so it's kind of like, it might have just happened anyway with San Francisco and the Bay Area.
I saw Operation Ivy the day after I moved to San Francisco, and I didn't like them at all. And now people are like, oh, I would have killed to see Op Ivy. I was like, eh. They opened for Fugazi. They opened for Fugazi. So, and it was a benefit for Homocore. And I went and I thought, oh, there's going to be all these gay rock guys there. No.
You had to build it, and then they came.
Yeah.
That's the reality, right? And sorry, Chris, you were about to say.
Oh, I'd forgotten.
Because
when I say Homocore, I mean Tom Jennings magazine, Homocore. It was a benefit for that, not.
And a zine that got out there in terms of distribution, like another thing that kind of like had, a bigger reach than JD's was ever able to kind of get in the prior era.
So when I left Seattle, it was September of 87. So I was listening to the acetates at my job at Muzak with Bruce Pavitt, listening to the first Green River and Soundgarden, which became the first two singles. And I was like, this is great. But, you know, this is dead. on Sub Pop. And I said, this is great. I love this shit. You know, I love what you're doing, but there's no place for me here. And I think Seattle, all the great bands in Seattle had all left. And now you got this new scene bubbling up. But I left it to go to San Francisco, because as soon as I went out to the clubs the first night, it was like, Primus is over here. What, Dred Zeppelin over here. I mean, it was just like, there's so much music everywhere. And I knew something had to happen with San Francisco much faster than it was going to happen in Seattle. And then I was wrong. I was wrong about Seattle.
But it was right for you. Because you
it was right for me.
With some
correct.
Of those people who
That's correct.
Were in bands, not the big
and they
ones.
Didn't, and they didn't want a gay bass player. No. That's true.
Not to, like, you know, expose anyone in particular unless you feel like it, but like, what were the kind of bands where it was like, were you trying to get into some sort of like the...
Well, I was, you know, because my band Attachments broke up at the end of 85, and I left like just under 2 years later. So the remains of that band, we kept struggling. So I would talk to other people who already knew me and knew me in this other band. And some of them I was working with, like Mark Arm, Tad, Chris Pugh from Swallow, Mark Gunther from the Cowboys, people like that, where we were like, okay, well, and they were all like, yeah, it's an issue. You know, we don't want to, we like you, but there's that would always take over. If you were, you know, if it was out, it would just take over. So I could never get an audition with any of the bands that I liked, because I thought as soon as Attachments was over, I felt I'd put in my dues with a band that I loved but didn't fully resonate with me musically. And here's all these other bands that I was loving, like you mentioned H Hour and Green River. And I was just like, can I join one of you guys? I want to play in Green River. I want to... And no.
You brought up the Cowboys. Was that kind of like, they would have been, I imagine, and I guess the Attachments too. Like, it seems like sonically, I know you're all friends and working together and you're fans of this stuff, but like, would you guys have overlapped playing shows, or is it kind of like different?
Oh, we played with the Cowboys later on. Yeah.
Would they have been playing with like a Green River or with like a Tad? Like, it's kind of a different.
No, so Green River essentially started in 85, but the scene had already closed. So, you know, that term, I think I've mentioned this before, but the term in a restaurant, when you run out of something on the menu, you say it's 86th. Well, 1986 was the year that Seattle died, and it was rebirthed in something else. Cause then that Deep Six compilation came out towards the end of that year. And then all of a sudden something happened in 87, but I was already on my way out. Because I didn't see any place for me here.
And you know, it's funny about Green River. Green River's album, what was it called? Come On Down?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Came out on Homestead, the label that the Outnumbered were on. So there weren't a lot of places to get records out if you were an American band in the 80s. So we sounded nothing like Green River. I saw them play once. And it really wasn't my thing. I did not mourn them. I also saw them with a crazy Seattle band called the U-Men.
Oh yeah.
Fantastic.
Also on Homestead. Yeah. I liked them better, but they were really out there.
Tom Price was in a band. One of my first local band shows was at the Windermere Field House. Right above right below Sandpoint. And it was the Red, Black, and White, which became the Fastbacks, and Psycho Pop. And Tom Price was the lead singer. He was like the Sting in that band. I was like, oh my God, I'm mesmerized. He's amazing. And then, you know, of course, the U-Men, amazing.
Whoa, that's awesome. The pre-Fastbacks band. Like, they were a band I really wanted to bring up to you, because they're a band that I think, because they don't fit into that sound, kind of get overlooked in the Seattle thing. And I think if they were from the Bay, probably would have been more a part of the thing that they could have sonically fit in with.
Absolutely. Except that they did end up on Sub Pop. And that
Yeah.
But like,
they got open for Pearl Jam. The same thing over for Green Day.
But I think
they didn't go over very well. We did. I think we went over better.
Because I think sonically they would have fit in better on that tour. with you guys than they would have on a Pearl Jam.
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. And you know, they just put out a new single, Fastbacks. So they're back in action.
And never, like yourselves, never put out a bad record. You know, and they have a longer, not to take anything away from you, but like a longer run of those records too. Yeah, it's absolutely. Like wild
they have an extra decade. Right off the bat, that was, they were, their whole idea was we want to put our records out. I'm like, you could just do that? I was what, 18, I think, when I saw them, and I was like, oh my God. Oh, that's interesting. And then we found out that our brothers went to high school together. So Kurt Block's older brother, my older brother, went to the same high school, but Kurt was a year older than me. So, but yeah.
Kurt's been on the show one time, but he did it in character. So I had to try and decipher the reality from the character to get the facts I needed.
He used to sell me records, though. He used to work in the U District at Cellophane Record. Or no, he used to work at Roxy Music. And he had cut his hair off after the first time I saw him. It was all bleached. And I'm like, you did that. I mean, I just, you know, I was marveling at people like, but I could do that. Let me tell you. So he would be like, yeah, I'm looking for a bootleg. Here, you want that? It's over here. And so he sold me some of my first records. Yeah.
He's still like, Tony Molina was on the podcast who, you know, fantastic. Yeah. And Tony talks about how much Kurt was an important role in his musical journey. Like he's still,
I listened to that podcast of yours.
Yeah. Tony made me take it down, unfortunately, cause he didn't really like how the shape he was in on the show. So unfortunately it's gone forever, but I love that part talking about Kurt. Cause it shows that he's still that guy for musicians and people making this music. A true lifer. And he was also the guy that pointed out the Wiz Kids and how important they were to kind of like, they're like the proto punk. And they opened, I guess there's a documentary about this on KXEP. I think that's the station, right? Call letters? KEXPs. Apologies. But they have a great documentary about the Wiz Kids opening for Alice Cooper and just how poorly that went over performance art troupe opening for Alice Cooper and, God, 75, 74. So,
wow.
You know, Green Day levels of hate, I imagine, thrown at them.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to, like, you know, find out from yourselves, do you think the stuff was going enough in the Bay Area that it could have been something without that Nirvana explosion happening? Like, did it feel like momentum was kind of happening there regardless? For sure. Because by 91, you guys were putting out that first tape.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. There was so much talent in that town.
I just remember
what's going on.
Working at Rough Trade, we distributed records. You know, we got records from Mortem that we would also sell through Rough Trade distribution. So I was working for both the label and the distro. So, you know, we'd get in the Green Day stuff and it would just fly out the door. And I knew who they were, but I didn't really know what they sounded like. But you know, there is this really big underground movement that had come out of Gilman Street and you know, the thing about those Gilman Street bands, some of them don't sound like what you would have thought coming out of, you know, an all ages punk club. A lot of it wasn't that punk. It was just kind of unusual and odd, punkish maybe, but you know, it wasn't, you know, straight ahead, downstroke punk. And so, you know, I think that would have continued to have grown regardless of Nirvana. And of course, without Nirvana, it's hard to predict what Green Day's career would have been like, because it just blew the doors open. And then a couple years later, Green Day can walk through them, having earned it by selling, you know, tens of thousands of copies of records on Lookout. So, you know, they didn't just get grabbed. They had really earned taken their own steps up the ladder to get there.
The other thing, like the thing that really attracted me initially about San Francisco, because I was going to move to LA, which would have meant buying a car and learning how to drive.
He lives in LA now and he drives.
I do. And I drive a car now. But what attracted me was 415 Records. You know, you have this band of, you know, that's having this huge song that's in every, on every radio and in every dance club, you know,
Never Say Never
by Romeo Void. And I thought that's unusual. It's totally catchy and it's on an independent label. That was what I was looking for with Attachments. Like, why can't something unusual that's poppy and stands out get to this level? And that's what really brought me to that, to coming down to San Francisco. So I even got to tell Howie that later, once we met him, I'm like, I'm a huge fan of yours. You put out all these great records. And he goes, I think you mean Seymour. And I'm like, no, Howie, it's you. You had Red Rockers. You had,
yes,
you know, Romeo Void. Come on. I know.
Pearl in the Harbors. Is that another?
Yeah. Pearl Harbor and the Explosions.
Pearl Harbor and the Explosion. That's it. And then also,
they were in Warner Brothers. They skipped the indie. They went right to the big label. So they didn't stay there.
First 7-inch is on 415.
I have the 7-inch too, I think, somewhere. Well,
and also 415, it's even more interesting because it begins in New Orleans, right? Like, that's where the Red Rockers first 7-inch comes out of, and then it moves up. Mm-hmm. And I think last time we talked about this on the show, and I just re-listened to the episode, Chris, but you talked about Mr. Bill's, a club named after Mr. Bill. Yeah. I recently found out that Mr. Hands on Mr. Bill belonged to Vance DeGeneres, Ellen DeGeneres' brother, who played bass in The Cold, the New Orleans power pop band.
So if you dig deep enough, everything's
connected eventually. You know, you can eventually find these.
That is crazy.
Yeah, very weird. And also, Jello Biafra sings backups on that Red Rockers LP, which I've always wanted to ask him about.
Hmm. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, that angry, a quote-unquote punk rocker that broke his legs for being on a major label, I don't think even knew about that one, or would have been even more pissed. But it was like a moment of, like, as like a amazing time as it was for the scene, it does seem like a moment of great sort of like fraught within the punk scene of success coming to town. And certainly Jawbreaker got a lot of hate and have talked about it when they were on the show. And Billy Joe talked about how they got, like, a lot of people telling them straight to their faces how they're kind of ruining things.
You're talking about the influence of Maximum Rock and Roll earlier. That's the downside of it. The Stalinist purism. You know, I could never take that. And, you know, it's, you know, hardcore was really not my thing. And I, you know, but they covered a big umbrella in Maximum Rock and Roll, but you could tell where their heart was. And, you know, I remember one of my favorite records of the time that I moved to San Francisco was the album Rock and Roll by the Mekons. And it came out as an independent record on Blast First in England, and then it came out on A&M in America. And the Blast First record got reviewed with Tim Yohannan saying, they don't sound like Where Were You anymore. You know, this absolutely stuck attitude about, you know, things advancing beyond a certain punk purism. So the thing is, now punk takes on all kinds of sounds. And I think that's great. But back then, they were the gatekeepers. And, you know, they were the ones who, you know, didn't think Green Day were punk. So, you know, I think Green Day really felt like one reason they felt like they had something to prove was to you know, because that was their peer group, like the MRR people. They're living in a warehouse in Oakland. You know, that's what the punk rockers did. You know, you go to the city and then you have this, you know, meager existence, but you get to play punk rock, which is great. But, you know, I just thought it was limited. So I feel like, you know, we can look at Green Day as like a Bay Area punk success, but a lot of punks in the Bay Area didn't want to give them that.
And it's really interesting because when I got into punk, it was reading about the Ramones, Talking Heads, Blondie, and Television. And those were the four that you would read about. And that's what punk was. And none of them sounded the same.
Mm-hmm.
They were all in the same, come from virtually the same corners. But here's how they all kind of, here's what we're going to do. And that to me was so interesting, because then I'd hear Devo and all this other, and I thought, okay, this is meant to like do whatever, go crazy with whatever you want to do. There's no more rules. You can do anything. And that to me was what punk was. You can do anything. And then to have it sort of shaved down into, no, you can only do this. That seemed anti-punk to me. That sounded to me like, okay, that's every band trying to sound like Bad Company. That's what you're telling me. That's what you're trying to do. Because punk should never have rules.
But I think that's why it is so punk, that dogmatic mentality, because you're right. Punk doesn't have rules. And to some people, it's like a religion, right? And like some people interpret that as, I need to make the rules then. If there are no rules to this thing, I'm going to come up and give that structure. And like, punk is always the thing. It survives because it always attracts cool outsiders. And some of those people are neurodiverse. And some of those people, in retrospect, when you look at the dogmatic kind of way they approach this thing and how it had to be their way or the highway, you're like, oh, that's a display of neurodiversity. Like, I can recognize that behavior in myself as a younger person and realize that I needed this sense of ownership over this thing. I finally had power over this little world. Like, I created my own little universe with it. And I was threatened anytime someone would push against that, be it something as ridiculous as just because they were making a different sonic than I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
At this point, it's almost 9 o'clock here. So I've got to go.
I totally get it.
But we're not done yet. So what did you want to talk about that we haven't talked about?
Well, actually, I could talk to you both forever, and I would like to open the door to part threes to both of you.
Okay, we could do it, yeah.
Because there's a lot more to talk to, and this has been, you know, just proof positive that there was a lot more for me to get to. And anytime either or both of you want to come back, together or separately, you are always both welcome still.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jamie.
But we have time a little bit for another question, right?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.